our talk today is by Professor Todd Henderson, and he's talking to the CEOs are underpaid.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. Time is at a premium, but so is food, so I will try not to take it personally that they have to have food to attract everybody. Okay, so CEOs are underpaid. How many people in here think CEOs are overpaid? Show of hands. Okay, I'll know who not to ask questions to. Okay, so this may be a bit of an overstatement. I'll let you decide at the end. The evidence that I'm going to talk about today is not going to prove to you that CEOs are underpaid. At the best, I'll hope for underpaid. But I think I should be able to convince you, at least hopefully convince you, that they're not overpaid on average. And probably more importantly, that they're not inefficiently paid on average. Okay, so the show of hands in the room suggests that people read the newspaper, that people read the New York Times, and here's the New York Times from April 8th, 2006, and I guess I want to start with the question, who is this guy? Because you're led to believe this is, well, he's white, he's in a tie and a suit, and he looks like he's fleeing the scene with a briefcase full of money. This looks like a CEO. And whose money is this that he's taking? Well, this may be the shareholders' money. That would be the implication. We'll come back to this. Because I don't think, and I think the evidence doesn't support the notion that this is the CEO. This is somebody else. It could be this guy. This is the Alan Mulally who was recruited to run Ford from Boeing. He made $28 million in 4 months. Good gracious, $28 million. That is more money than any of us. Well, we had one guy in my class who's now a movie producer who founded PayPal, and he's got more than $28 million. The rest of us, we have no chance. We've ever seen. He made it in 4 months. This is the guy, the CEO that the New York Times has in mind. Or maybe it's this guy. This is Jack Welch, who ran General Electric for about 20 years. And according to the World Socialist website, this is where I get all of my here is some details from his retirement package. Let's just assume, as I do everything I read on the website, this is true. $9 million a year, a company apartment, daily fresh cut flowers provided by the shareholders of General Electric. It's scandalous. It's nuts, right? A box at the Metropolitan Opera, who wouldn't want that? Tickets to all these games, and unlimited use of a corporate Boeing 737. Hoo-wee, greedy, fat cat CEOs taking money from shareholders. Okay, so as I said, my punchline is CEOs of large public companies on average are not overpaid, they're not efficiently paid. Paper performance is very strong. Data from cases in which the power of shareholders is very strong. There's a couple of examples I'll give suggest that CEOs are paid about right. At the very least, the proposed reforms of CEO pay, that is, empower shareholders, if only shareholders would stand up to these sons of guns, they'd make a lot less money. And it's only because shareholders are confused that they make so much money, I'm going to hopefully show that that's not the case. Okay. So the debate, there's two parts of the debate. The first part is the populist arguments. You'll see this from the AFL-CIO in a second. Comparing shareholders with the rest of us. These guys make millions. The average worker can barely afford to send their kid to college if they can't even do that. Just trying to make ends meet. And boy, look at U.S. CEOs compared with those in other countries. So that's kind of the populist argument. These guys are just overpaid. The academic argument is largely they're inefficiently paid. If they were being paid efficiently, we wouldn't care how much they made. No one criticizes Tiger Woods because he makes millions, because we don't think there's something broken about the way Tiger Woods is being paid. But Baird and Rasmussen say, these CEOs don't need such strong incentives. And Bebchuk and Fried, academics from Harvard and Berkeley respectively, say directors don't know how much these things cost, managers have all the incentives to structure their pay in a way that gets them lots of money, and shareholders, you own shares of a mutual fund. High and when all sorts of diffuse shareholders rise up and challenge CEO pay. So, two questions for us. Is compensation too high? Is the process broken? So here's just a quick setting of the table. Here's the AFL-CIO. The ratio of CEO pay to the average worker has gone from 42 times in 1980, the election of Ronald Reagan, to over 411 times today. Here's another cut of this data using some recent data from Friedman and Sachs. Going back to 1936, and it was high in the 30s, but then relatively flat, around 40 times, and then a huge increase. Number of press mentions about excessive executive compensation. You can see lots of them and going up over time, over that period. Corporate watchdogs criticizing retirement packages for executives. This is the Corporate Library. Hedge funds. Here's an example of a hedge fund who looked at a corporation, saw bloated fat cats, came in, took over the corporation, and tried to change executive compensation. Some recent data from Randall Thomas and Brav and others. This is CEO compensation around the time when a hedge fund would come in. So this is the time when a hedge fund comes in here at T. You can see the compensation is very high at that point and falls afterwards. In other words, these are firms where the hedge funds see they can come in, reduce costs, operate the company as efficiently, reducing CEO pay. And you can see on the right side here, CEO turnover going way up. Institutional shareholders submitting precatory proposals, that is, proposals that are not binding on the corporation for shareholder vote. This number of 38% of proposals are about executive pay. Institutional shareholders care about this. This number is way up from what it was 10 years ago. Plaintiff's lawyers have brought lots of suits. The Disney case, many of you may have seen, Michael Ovitz made $140 million for a year of really bad work. And he was sued by shareholders to get that money back. The New York Stock Exchange and the Attorney General, Spitzer, and now Cuomo, suing Richard Grasso to get back some of his $190 million pay package. For those of you who have taken corporate law, know these cases are very hard to win. The standard for pay, the business judgment rule, is almost impossible to prevail under. Plaintiffs have to show that the money was wasted. That is, they got nothing in return. Very, very unlikely they'll be able to win those cases. So far, the cases have been mixed. In Delaware, Ovitz got to keep his $140 million, and the board members weren't liable for paying it to him. In New York, the case went ahead against the New York Stock Exchange board for overpaying Grasso. This was under a special New York statute, a nonprofit statute. But last night at about 10 o'clock, it came across the wire that the appeals court in New York reversed. So that case still is being played out. Congress is in on this. This is my former congressman, Barney Frank. I was very well represented by Representative Frank when I lived in Newton, Massachusetts. And he has a bill pending in Congress now to say on pay bill, a moderate and temperate approach to the issue of runaway executive compensation. And here's our president on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange saying two important things. The government shouldn't be the decider here. Bush is the decider, remember, but not about executive compensation. It's up to the board. The board should be the decider, and there's a hint in here in this quote that he thinks boards have been shirking on their duties about overseeing executive compensation. By statute, Delaware and every other state, the board has the power to set compensation. So you can think of the shareholders and other capital providers of the firm. They hire the board, and the board hires the executives, and the board gets to decide how to pay the executives. Of course, the problem with this is agency costs. The shareholders appoint the board, but then they're all sitting there farming in Iowa somewhere, and the board and the CEO become buddies. The CEO has influence over the board, which we'll see in a second. And the shareholders, the principals here, they've delegated their agents to make these decisions, but the agents are making decisions that are not in the interest of the principals. That's agency costs. Other people's money is another way of thinking about this. In other words, the directors are paying people's money. That is me and you, the shareholder. This is in quotes. It obviously comes from the Danny DeVito movie from the 90s of that title. This is the review from the New Yorker. I'm offended by this review on so many levels. The main character is a greedy, unscrupulous Wall Street wizard known as Larry the Liquidator, who's trying to buy this poor New England wire and cable company, right? The business is run by Gregory Peck, old-fashioned values of heat, free enterprise, hates debt, he wears a cardigan sweater. It's terrible, right? And then, of course, you have to have the leggy, but devious woman corporate lawyer. And it's just terrible, right? Filled with horrible stereotypes. This isn't what I mean by other people's money. What I mean by other people's money is this very influential book by Louis Brandeis, who authored the Brandeis Brief, basically introduced sociological and empirical research to law in the case of Mueller versus Oregon in the Supreme Court. And he wrote this book about how other bankers and big companies were taking money from me and you and using it for their own ends. Wall Street versus Main Street. So here's our academic Bebchuk and Fried, or Fried and Bebchuk. Flawed compensation agreements are persistent, widespread, and they stem from defects in governance. Executives influence over boards, who are supposed to be their boss, allows the pay to increase. Here are two SEC commissioners. Empowering shareholders will help control lazy, ineffective, and grossly overpaid CEOs. And the solution is independence of the board and more power to the shareholders. Who could be opposed to this? More oversight. That's a good thing. Here's the book treatment of this, right? Our view is instrumental and shareholder-oriented. We would accept higher compensation if it were beneficial for performance. So here, this is a purely academic argument, the efficiency argument. We don't care what the average worker pay is to CEO, that ratio. We just want to make sure these guys are being paid efficiently. Okay, so this is some Chicago research. This is supposed to be Chicago's best ideas. Whether it's best or not, I will leave to you all and to posterity. Compensation contracts. We look at compensation contracts in low agency cost environments compared with high agency cost environments. That is, public firms where the shareholders are diffuse and disinterested and have very little incentive to monitor, compared with situations where the shareholders are really in control and have every incentive to monitor, and we compare the compensation contracts in those two environments. That would give us a good test, I would think, of whether this agency cost explanation is really what is driving the compensation level. So we look at about 80 firms that were in financial distress over a 10-year period. We'll talk in a second more about why financial distress is a relevant metric here. But basically the idea is the shareholders go away. A firm declares bankruptcy, shareholders disappear. A couple of large banks, a couple of ultra investors buy up the entire company, and they rewrite the employment contracts with the executives. In those cases, the reform suggested by the critics on how to pay CEOs and amounts to pay CEOs are not implemented. So you have sophisticated investors who are betting their own money, hundreds of millions of dollars of their own money to turn around the company. They write employment contracts anew, and lo and behold, they write exactly the same kind of contracts that diffuse disinterested shareholders and their lackeys on the board write for executives. So if the theory is that managers use their power of office to extract economic rents, they use social control over board members, the Jedi mind trick, right? You should pay me $100 million, right? That's the theory here. Carrots and sticks, and the solution is increased role for investors. We look at these in situations in which firms are under financial distress. If we see that the practices are unchanged, we could say boldly, and maybe wrongly, that these contracts are first best efficient. That is, they're the optimal, they'll never be improved. I think I'd have a hard time convincing anybody that that was the case. You could say the sort of semi-strong version, given all the costs, the social, psychological, transaction costs, the insight that Ronald Coase gave us, that these are optimal contracts given the cost at that particular time in history. There will be learning. We'll learn that somebody will abuse something and somebody contract will be bad, but given that that time in history, the best we could expect. Or the weakest form, what I think everybody should take away from this is, super empowered shareholders, owners who really cared and wrote these contracts would write the same ones. So this is just a catalog of what Bebchuk and Fried suggest are the reasons why CEOs have power over boards. Social and psychological factors. There's the there but for the grace of God go I argument that these people are also CEOs and they know that they'll be judged by these higher standards. So it's a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of a thing. And the proposed reforms, and this is just a catalog, is all about increasing shareholder power. So Dent here says, what we need to do for healthy firms is create committees of the 10 to 20 biggest shareholders, and they should monitor executives. My thesis here is this is exactly what goes on in bankruptcy. Thousands, hundreds of millions of shareholders are replaced by, well, it's actually way less than 10 to 20. It's probably a couple of super empowered shareholders who own the entire firm. And that's the test case we have, and the case where they write exactly the same contracts. Why is agency cost lower in Chapter 11? Well, you can take bankruptcy, for those of you who haven't, and learn more about this from Professor Baird. But the gist here is that all of the debt, which is held by multiple parties, gets morphed into one single debt facility that one bank then controls. This is especially true because debt is freely tradable now, so it all usually moves into the hands of one or two capital providers. There's lower monitoring costs in bankruptcy, so the creditors and creditors' committees get access to information, unparalleled levels of information about the debtor. There are formal committees and processes and transfer of information. And compensation is obviously much more salient in bankrupt companies. These companies are earning a lot less. So, boy, $100 million to an executive is a really meaningful thing for a company that's teetering on the edge or in bankruptcy. In Chapter 11, what happens with respect to compensation contracts, these are executory contracts, which means things that haven't happened yet, they're torn up. They don't survive the bankruptcy process, so the first thing the creditors do is rip up the CEO's compensation contract and write a new one. The creditors, and there were a variety of interviews done for this, they view this, that is, finding the right person and making sure she is compensated correctly and with the right incentives as the most important thing they do after they get the finances figured out. And if there are objections to the bankruptcy process and how they're paying executives, all creditors can file objections with the court. And they do, and I lay out in the paper hundreds of examples whereby creditors of various kinds have objected and said, boy, we think you're paying the CEO too much. The court will look at it and review the process. So there's actual judicial supervision. The creditors usually take board seats. There's fewer protections for bankrupt companies. The normal litany of defenses that board members usually have, as you're talking about in corporate law, the business judgment rule, insurance, that directors, even if they make galactically stupid decisions, can be protected. Those things don't apply in bankruptcy. And finally, judicial review in every case in the data set, the courts looked very closely at the compensation contracts and signed off on them. Okay, so critics look at these various provisions of executive compensation as particularly egregious. Let's focus on just one here, that is at-the-money non-index stock options. That means you're given a stock option, which is the price at which you can cash out is the current trading price. So the stock's trading at $10. The strike price is $10. So if the stock price goes up to $15, you can cash that in for $5, okay? Non-index means if the stock goes up from 10 to 15, you can cash that in for $5. Index stock options would say, well, let's compare how the firm is doing with a bunch of other businesses that are like us, and only if we outperform them will the stock price can you exercise and cash in. So to give you a quick example, you're the CEO of an oil company, and lo and behold, we invade Iraq. And oil prices rise tremendously. the value of Exxon stock will rise, and the CEO will see that benefit in his or her stock options. But did she do anything to increase the value of Exxon? Did shareholders in Exxon benefit compared with what they could have gotten from Amoco or BP or any other company? No. So the critics say, this is so obvious, the intuition is so patently obvious, that only a captured board would write non-index stock options. Only a board under the mind control of the CEO. These are completely unchanged in bankruptcy. So sophisticated creditors who are betting $500 million, $1 billion on the firm, who tear up these contracts, write exactly the same contracts as a shareholder. So here's a table showing these particular terms, examples of them in the pre-distress period and the post-distress period, and you can see trivial changes. So obviously, even though Professor Bebchuk and Professor Fried believe that only an idiot would write these options, and they have reasons for why they think the boards are idiots, it's hard to believe that sophisticated vulture investors and banks who are writing these articles. The story for amounts is about the same. Compensation, you can see this on the charts here. Compensation in and around bankruptcy falls. So during the period where the firms are in bankruptcy, the amounts fall, but then they rise very quickly afterwards. This is because stock options are pretty much meaningless during this period. The firms in bankruptcy, it has no equity. The really relevant thing is to look at, well, what kind of equity grants are they giving out after the firm emerges from bankruptcy? And in the paper, I take out the obvious performance bonus. So there's, you can imagine, if you wanted this curve to just be smooth across here, this gap would be filled in by additional bonus over here. Even taking that into consideration, amounts of compensation are effectively the same as they were in the pre-period. Okay, so managerial power is severely constrained in Chapter 11. There's evidence, strong evidence of actual bargaining, and I talked to tons of creditors who operate in this space, and they confirm what my intuition is, that they actually bargain over these. And compensation levels and forms are about what they were in the pre-period. Okay, so that's what we can take away to stop and take stock here for a second. It can't be agency costs. It can't be the only reason why CEOs are overpaid is because shareholders are asleep at the wheel, effectively. So now if we turn to the question of whether they're underpaid, this is Steve Kaplan, who was here yesterday on a panel discussion talking about a similar topic. His quote from the Harvard Corporate Governance blog: the median CEO is probably underpaid these days. Where does this justification come from? First, some facts. Here's CEO pay over the last 10 years. You can see it's been rising. The last 5 years, the constant growth rate of about 6%, over a 10-year period, about 10%. A breakdown of the typical mix of compensation and how it's been changed. You can see a little bit move away from stock options and more in bonus and restricted stock. So there's been some learning. How big are these numbers? It's a pretty big number. Total CEO compensation for the biggest 1,600 firms in the U.S. In 2005, about $9 billion. But of course, this is trivial in comparison to things like sales and revenues. Right? It's an insignificant speck for most firms. This chart, which comes from Kevin Murphy at USC, shows the blue line is cash pay for CEOs from 1970. This is the relevant period when CEO compensation became an issue. So over this 35-year period, cash pay has increased a little bit, but boy, the big change, the driver of all of the increase is stock options. 99% in 1980 was salary and bonus, 1% equity, and now it looks more like 80-20. This is partially because of a very influential article in the Harvard Business Review. CEO incentives, it's not how much you pay, but how you pay. That was in 1990. And you can see before this time period, the criticism was CEOs were paid like bureaucrats. I have a bigger firm, I get more money. Sensible. I've got 50,000 employees, that's a tougher job than 5,000 employees. I've got more responsibilities, I should make more money. The incentive, therefore, for CEOs, if I told you you were paid based on how big your firm is, what would you do? you maximize the size of your firm. We see an era of lots of conglomerates that weren't efficient. They didn't make lots of money, but their CEOs got paid a lot because they ran big firms. And Jensen and Murphy say, stop. Pay them like owners. The real agency cost is they're being paid like bureaucrats, not like owners. If you align their interests with shareholders, they'll act to increase profitability and shareholder value. So that's what's driven this big change. And boy, for the critics who suggest that pay for performance is delinked in this country, this spike and then valley should be very strong evidence that that's the dot-com boom, 2001. CEOs making tons of money because stocks going through the roof, and then stocks aren't doing so well. Well, boy, they're making a lot less money. We'll come back to this chart. Here's another take on it. Here's salary and bonus, and the equity's in green, and you can see the growth rates. Cash growth at about 3 to 5%. That's not that much more than inflation. Bonuses going up a little bit more dramatically. If you just looked at the growth rate of salaries per year, you'd say 52%. Boy, that's an awful lot. But that's all driven by equity. Critics also point to international comparisons and say, boy, look, American CEOs are paid a lot more than other countries. This chart, which is, I'm sorry for being almost unreadable, but effectively these bars, so here's the U.S. down here at the bottom, and purple is cash, okay? This black line is the U.S. baseline, and you can see the U.S. pays less cash than every other country except South Africa as a percentage. Yellow is variable, right? And again, this black line represents the metric for the U.S. And you can see the U.S. pays more variable compensation than any other country. Finally, benefits and perks. And again, the U.S. pays almost less than almost every other country in terms of benefits and perks. So why are our CEOs making more money? Because we pay them based on how well they do. Shock, the horror that we should pay someone based on their performance. That's what this suggests. And then coded to this is all these other countries, at least the smart ones, and I won't identify what the smart ones are all moving towards U.S.-style compensation. So stock options, which were, brace yourselves, illegal in Germany 10 years ago, are now being used widely in Europe. Criticizing stock options, again, is easy, but this chart shows something pretty dramatic, and that is the total dollar value of stock options in grants issued over this period. And the itty-bitty bit at the top, the icing on this cake, is the amount taken by CEOs. The rest of these bars are people at Cisco, secretaries at eBay, who were also getting stock options. Now let's put aside the obvious problem with paying a secretary in stock options, right? This doesn't make any sense. The secretary is not incentivized to type any faster because she's got stock options. What effect she has on the bottom line, I don't know. But for those critics who say, this is just the rich fat cats taking all the money, if we criticize stock options, you're going to be taking out a bunch of wealth that's going, variable wealth that's going to other people. Okay, so a couple of reasons why I think CEOs may be underpaid, and then I'll stop and take questions. First, less job security. So here's that chart I showed showing the growth of pay and the average tenure at the bottom here of CEOs in years. The average tenure has fallen from 10 years to 5 years. Boy, if Bebchuk were here, I'd want to ask him one question, and that is, why in a world in which managers can pull the Jedi mind trick, or my two-year-old likes the Jafar reference better, right, in the, what's the, not the Lion King, the, not Jafar, the guy with the,
Aladdin,
right, the guy with the, what's his name, not Jafar,
Jafar,
oh yeah. So if we just did a very simple, crude piece of math, which is we multiply the salary times your expected life expectancy at that firm, the growth rate looks a lot less, right? So I come into a firm, what do I expect to get out of the firm? The change has been pretty dramatic. an unquestioned axiom should be that more risk is more pay. If I'm going to bear more risk doing something, I'm going to demand more money in return for bearing that risk. So why is it more risky today to be a CEO? There's been some big changes. One is, we'll send you the slammer, right? 25 years, the increased scrutiny of CEOs in terms of potential for losing your liberty. In addition, disclosure about CEO performance increases transparency about how that CEO is performing. That might be a good thing. We think transparency is good. We want to know more about you. If you're doing a bad job, we'll fire you. But boy, the CEO doesn't want you to know how good she's doing. She prefers less information getting into the market, so that board's less well able to judge her performance. If you increase disclosure, she's going to have to be compensated to bear that risk. Heberlin, and this is Weisbach, this is not David Weisbach, this is his brother. Michael Weisbach have a very excellent paper. They do a model on this, which I will not bore you with. The other is liability risk. So for the first time in a long time, we've seen directors and officers of companies who've been personally liable for the kinds of claims I mentioned here in the past. Right? It's possible, given accounting restatements and other types of corporate wrongdoing, that officers might be on the hook personally. And again, as you increase the risk in liability, CEOs are going to have to be compensated for that. Another example of super-empowered owners, just like my bankruptcy example, are private firms. And this is just anecdotal evidence because we don't have great information of how much private firms are willing to pay. But here's three examples of executives who were very successful at public companies who were lured to private firms because the private firms were able to pay them a lot more money. So it's not just, one would be, private firms pay the same as public firms. That's my study about the bankruptcy. And we say, boy, that says public firms are getting it about right. But this is, they're willing to pay a lot more. Hence, maybe CEOs and public companies are underpaid. They have greater scrutiny. Companies can't afford to pay them because they face publicity and public relations costs. So here's an example. This guy was running General Electric's $47 billion aircraft unit. Every company in the country wanted him to be their CEO, and he went, and he's the CEO of a company that no one's ever heard of. Right? They have some media assets, and they paid him $100 billion, something in this current environment companies probably couldn't do. So these examples are filled with the kind of abuses that Bebchuk and Fried suggest are only because shareholders are sitting on their rights. Finally, there's been a tight linkage between stock performance and firm size and value. Okay, so all I've done here is taken that chart we saw before with the pay, which is in the red, and laid on top of it market value, the stock market returns over the same period. And, wow, what do you see? They're exactly correlated. This is not surprising because most of the CEO compensation is equity. As firms have gotten richer, CEOs have gotten richer. Now, what do you notice about this, which is a little strange, and leads again to maybe this underpay point? Something happened. Well, we'll come back to that in a second. I'm sorry, I screwed up. Okay, so more Chicago research. This isn't mine, however. This is Steve Kaplan's and Josh Rao. Top decile firms in terms of pay outperform their industries by 50%. So firms where they pay their CEOs a lot outperform firms where they don't pay them very much. Again, the CEOs in these companies being paid like owners and have the incentives to do well. Another paper shows a strong linkage between firm size and value, something we wouldn't find very surprising. Friedman and Sachs, again, this is the historical data. This is top compensation of the top three executives relative to market value and sales. And you can see this is the 1936 level. And we are in the 2000 period way below and about historically over that period of 1950 through 2005. It's pretty constant, the ratio of CEO pay or the top three executive pay to market value and sales. Okay, so this is where I was going to go before. What do you see that's different about this curve in the last couple of years? Well, boy, Bebchuk and Fried have this paper in the University of Chicago Law Review for an executive compensation symposium in 2002. And for the first time since, well, I don't know, the 1980s, we've seen a huge break between market value and how much CEOs are paid. So we're in an environment in which scrutiny is potentially higher, where firms are feeling like they can't pay their CEOs. You see CEOs leaving to go to private firms and a deviation between firm value and compensation. Okay, back to Jack Welch to end. We thought maybe he was the guy in the running away in the briefcase in the beginning. GE, what did they get for these negotiations there where they agreed to give him fresh cut flowers? Well, one thing is, and we have, I have a paper on this called Corporate Heroin. It would be sensible for the board, they wrote this contract in 1996, to give him lots of benefits that would happen way in the future. Why? Because Welch would be reliant on the firm way into the future. They could, let's say they found out that in the year before he left, he committed some fraud. If they just gave him cash and had to sue him and try to get that money back, that's very, very hard to do. Almost no cases are successful. If instead they gave him fresh cut flowers in the box at the opera and they found out he cheated the year before he left, committed some fraud, they just take it away. No more fresh cut flowers, right? The flower guy just doesn't show up tomorrow. So the linkage, the gold, it's like golden handcuffs in a sense, they tie him to the firm over a longer period of time. And perversely, the Sarbanes-Oxley made this kind of behavior illegal. Okay, so here is General Electric. General Electric is in blue and General Motors is in red. This period we've been talking about, the glory days when CEOs were paid like bureaucrats and we didn't have these ratios of average workers. The AFL-CIO wants to take us back to these days. Here's General Motors and here's General Electric. Jack Welch is hired in 1980 and ooh, look what happens, right? GE goes like crazy, their stock value increases. GE was worth about $10 billion when Jack Welch took over in 1980. When he left in 2001, it was worth $300 billion. A return in General Electric stock of $10,000 would have returned $600,000 to you as an investor. If you put the same money in the S&P, you would have got about $200,000. So here's Jack Welch, 1996. He's going to retire. And the board says, no, don't retire. And he says, okay, I'll stay until I'm 65, but I want you to bring me fresh cut flowers every day when I retire. What do you think? Do you think the board, you think the shareholders, would, faced with that, would say, here's your fresh cut flowers? Of course they would. They did. And look what happened to GE stock. Here, General Motors continues to plummet along, and GE is going through the roof. Welch retires, and GE is doing okay. Right? Pretty flat. So, if you asked a hypothetical investor here, you can invest $10,000, we'll send your kids to college and buy you a house, these are all inflation-adjusted dollars, you'd say, yes, I'll take that deal. And we have to believe, don't we, that there's no way that Congress or any of us want to keep boards from being able to make bets on people like Jack Welch. It could be that the person you bet on is a flaw. And you overpay because you incentivize them and it didn't work. Well, then you're bad at your job and you should be fired, and that's usually what happens. But boards have got to believe, we all have to believe, that people and individuals, leadership can make a difference in running companies, and boards have to be able to make these bets. So who is this guy in the briefcase? These are shareholders. Shareholders have gotten fabulously wealthy, and the New York Times just misses that. So we're left with some lingering questions. Why is the market for top talent getting more and more returns in our society? All of us, top talent, well, all of you at least, going on to do wonderful things, you are going to earn hugely disproportionate amounts of money. Why is that the case? This may be desirable. It may be desirable that they're growing income inequality gaps because that's just returns to capital. And usually we think returns to capital are a good sign. People are investing in some kind of capital and it's making lots of money. What does that cause other people to do? Invest in that kind of capital. If that kind of capital is a factory or cars or oil or human capital, that is our brains, we encourage people to invest more in their brains because there's greater returns to brains in our day and age. But there are, to be sure, social costs from this model. Growing inequality. It's a political question whether or not this is sustainable and what the social costs and benefits are. So if we think that there are costs and the costs are very high, how can we restrain pay? There's been lots of times, lots of mechanisms where we've tried to restrain pay. Disclosure, shame people, have companies provide more information that this doesn't work, right? You disclose information about the firm. What does that allow other firms to do? He's being paid how much? He gets a corporate jet. I want a corporate jet. Every time the government has put in place ceilings, change of control provisions, if they're above 3 times, then they're illegal. What happened? Everyone who had a change of control provision that was 1 time demanded 3 times. So ceilings become floors. So like Wobegon problem, nobody wants to be, everybody's above average, right? Nobody wants to pay below average. We could ban specific practices. The example of corporate loans I gave, the government always will get this wrong too. We can improve corporate governance. Boy, haven't we been doing that? If you took a poll, everyone would say governance in the U.S., corporate governance is as good as it's ever been, and salaries keep going up. We can also pay in other ways. We could raise taxes as one possible model, but the effects in our global economy may be stark. So here's the final slide, an example of the effect of taxes. This is the S&P. This is market value, this top line. And here's CEO pay. So we've looked at this part, right? We've looked at 1980 on, and they're roughly correlated. And we say, whoo, hooray, shareholders are getting big returns, and so are executives. What in the world is happening in here? Right? Doesn't this defeat my argument? Returns were very high and CEOs were being paid very little. So that's the relevant period, 1950 to 1980. Tax rates were like 90% on upper level income during that period. And the U.S. had just come out of a war. And there were tremendous changes, huge growth in the U.S. economy in the post-war period. And we basically were not in a global market. Potential rivals, Japan, Germany, the people we have rivalries with today, China, they didn't exist, right? They were under rubble. They were recovering and building their economies. So the question would be, is this viable today? Do we think if we raise taxes to 90% that we'd still have stock market gains and CEOs performing? Again, that's probably a political question and one where it's a complicated trade-off of social costs and benefits. So the problem here, the managers are paid like owners, but owners have been doing very well. We could pay managers like something else other than owners, but what would that be and what would the social costs of that be? Surely there are rotten apples. Certainly prosecution of people who commit fraud and certainly improving corporate governance are good steps to take. But remember that transparency and deterrence will have their own costs, to be sure. And ultimately, it's a political question whether or not we want to live in a society where we allow upper-level incomes to rise as an incentive for others to do well, an incentive for immigrants to come to the country and build businesses, or whether we feel like we need to constrain that pay in some way. Okay, and with that, I'll take your any questions. Yes?
Do you think that activist shareholders or what other mechanisms keep like diffuse shareholders as informed as the vultures, or at least behaving as though they're that informed?
Okay, so activist shareholders, there's a couple of varieties. One would be the hedge fund guys. And we saw some evidence that hedge funds come in and they'll cut pay. It's not clear that suggests that the CEOs were overpaid in the first period. Right? Why might that be? Well, first of all, the hedge fund guys are about as highly compensated as you can possibly imagine. 20, I think the stat I heard yesterday from Professor Kaplan was 20 hedge fund managers make more than 500 CEOs. So if you took 20 hedge fund managers, their compensation is higher than all 500 of the biggest companies in the United States. So these guys are making enormous amounts of money. And when they come into a company, the hedge funds, they provide some management skill. They want to turn the company around. They have things they're going to do. So the fact that they're displacing the CEO of some of the companies compensation, they don't need them to have as many stock options because they're going to be running part of the business, right? The shareholders are basically going to be running part of the business. Another reason why that amount of money might be reduced is because, you know, if you're doing a coup, the first thing you do is cut off the head of the king. And sending a signal to the market that, you know, we're in town, we're here, and we're going to kick some butt, the first thing we'll do is slash something in a very public way that is a signal to the market. So those kind of activist investors, they look a little bit more like the vulture guys, but I think the story is a little bit more complicated. Other types of activist investors, like public pension funds, boy, we should be very leery about what their motives are coming into firms, because unlike the hedge fund guys who really only have shareholder returns in mind, the public pension funds, they're optimizing along an entire suite of utility, effectively, right? They've got labor unions, they have political issues. They're trying to maximize along more dimensions than just shareholder value. So they come in and say, oh, we think this is what's going to be better for the company for shareholder value. I think we should be leery of believing that. And then other types of institutional investors like stock pickers at Fidelity, mutual fund managers. What are they? They could care less, right? Some 27-year-old guy with an MBA who thinks he can pick stocks better than anybody else and who's compensated only based on how his stocks that he picked last month are doing has no interest in how much the CEO is paying.
You said that the policy problem is that managers pay large owners. How do you justify the non-indexed options if the stockholders really getting the returns on the stock minus opportunity costs that might be invested there? Wouldn't we expect that the CEOs will also be paid on an index basis?
Yeah, so it's plausible. My first answer would be the one I've already given, which is I don't need to defend it. I don't have to have a reason, because what does some pinhead academic know about what's the sense of using index or non-index stock options? If people betting their own money don't think they're needed, then who am I to say, oh, you, this is your profession, you've been doing it for 30 years, and you've got $500 million bet on this, then you're wrong. Because, so that's my first thing.
You can't just point to what's happening in the market at any given time. You want to show that you admit that sometimes we learn from mistakes.
There is a literature. And it's complicated. There's a literature on reasons why index options are a bad idea. One is it's very complicated and potentially has negative implications from a tax standpoint. So giving index stock options is much more complicated from a tax standpoint and may be very costly for the firm for taxes. Another reason, and this is in the finance literature, is a lot of these option grants have highly embedded a very index quality to them, and it's extremely complicated. I don't understand the math. There's lots of Greek symbols and stuff, and my eyes glaze over. But, you know, the consensus in the finance literature is there's lots of good reasons why we don't have index stock options. And it might be sensible. It's not just, you know, my first cut into this. But knowing that there are at least theoretical reasons why, and then we also don't see it happening, is where I get to my first point. Yeah.
So you looked at companies before and after bankruptcy and compared executive compensation across them. Is it possible that there's different reasons for why executive compensation is at one level before and after bankruptcy? To give you a hypothetical, let's say that before bankruptcy, this agency cost that the Greg's talked about drives up compensation, and that's part of why the company goes into bankruptcy. And then the return on capital is so low because they're in bankruptcy that they don't really have anything better to spend money on, so they throw it at somebody that they think might be able to get them out.
Okay, so it's possible for sure, and let's just assume for the sake of this that you're right, okay, and that this may be a corrupt data set on that dimension. And so what I would suggest is, let's throw out the amount they're paid. Let's say, to be even stronger, to ask an even tougher question, if the whole market for CEO talent is broken, the fact that people are playing that market and they're not changing it doesn't suggest anything. In other words, the economic way of phrasing that is, Banker firms are price takers. They don't set the price. They take the price. The price is what it is. CEO talent commands a certain wage, and if the whole process for everybody else is broken, the fact that we can fix it, if we've got to pay CEOs the going rate, we've got to pay them the going rate. We're not going to hire Henderson to be our CEO. Okay? It's possible. I don't think that's right for a variety of reasons, but let's say that's right. There's still no reason to pay inefficiently. Right? So let's say the CEO's reservation wage, which is set by the market, which is completely corrupt in the way Benchuk suggests, is $10 million. We have to pay someone $10 million to join our firm. We're a banker firm. Heck, we gotta pay them more. Henderson told us, more risk is more pay. You gotta pay these guys more to come and run a banker firm because their reputation may be besmirched by failing. Why would you pay inefficiently? You're ripping up the contract, you're writing it anew. If you've got to meet the reservation wages to say $10 million, you can meet that in non-index stock options, inefficient, says Benchuk, or you can meet it in index stock options, right? You can, along all the deal points of the CEO's contract, there's no reason to pay, even if you have to pay the amounts in an inefficient form.
Will increased prosecution of the bad apples in the bad CEOs lead to relative overcompensation of good ones because the good ones perceive that they're bearing more risk on that front, even though they're doing a fine job and are not actually at risk?
Yeah, so it's possible. I mean, I guess that was kind of a cartoonish first-level suggestion from what I was suggesting, and that is every CEO, even the good ones, has increased liability risk. Especially if we believe, as some of the prosecutions have suggested, both by government and by plaintiff's lawyers, that these are not really tied to merits. Michael Ovitz did not steal. He didn't backdate options. He didn't take money out like people did at WorldCom. It wasn't Enron, right? Disney's a thriving company. He gave up a very successful career as a talent agent, left tons of money on the table, came over and joined the fund, was paid a lot of money, and then is dragged through litigation for 3 years, right? So he's kind of in your good bucket, even though he did a terrible job. He didn't commit any fraud or any criminal actions. So yes, and Richard Grasso, the New York Stock Exchange is going like gangbusters. He gets sued by the Attorney General to take back all this money. So I think clearly, yes, every CEO is concerned about potential risks that they face, and they'll go to their board and potentially demand more to compensate them for that.
Well, just a quick follow-up. Yeah. I mean, if that's the case, is there much, I just don't know the academic literature that well, is there much of an argument to be made for not increasing prosecution because it is so harmful to pretty good CEOs or decent ones?
I'm not seeing anybody, say that specifically. The closest I've seen is this Hermelin and Weisbach study is talking about transparency, which is just sort of a related point. So remember, though, that regulations have social costs, and just because they may increase pay doesn't mean that they're not net beneficial. So you might live in a world in which you said, good CEOs are going to be paid more to bear this risk, but the bad CEOs are going to go to jail for 25 years. There'll be a deterrent effect for committing fraud, even though you're going to be paid. The net for society, that's a net beneficial thing.
Yeah. So incentives matter. I'm a Chicago guy. I get that. But it seems like in the sort of history of executive compensation that you laid out, there's been in playing that game, there've been multiple iterations where it seems like boards have just gotten it wrong with regards to the metrics they look at in determining compensation. So revenue is a bad idea by devoted firms. Market cap may not have been a great idea because it slaps profits. Profits may not have been a great idea because. Yeah, so what is, in your view, the right way to align the incentives of the CEO with those of both the board and the shareholder?
So if I knew the answer to that question, I wouldn't be staying here.
Yeah,
we're making millions of dollars. Let me say this.
Both from the CEO perspective and...
Yeah, so I'll say this. So Professor Barron has this paper where he says, boards shouldn't get in the game of trying to tweak and fine-tune these things. It's just who you hire. Incentives don't really matter that much. Pick the right person and make sure she takes the job seriously, right? Be good on ex ante, and then be good ex post. When she screws up, you fire her. There's ex ante monitoring, there's ex post monitoring, there's also got to be ongoing monitoring incentives. And capitalism is a work in progress. And boards are going to be struggling. And the most important thing to take away, I think, is there's going to be enormous heterogeneity across firms. What's good for General Motors is not what's good for General Electric in terms of writing the optimal contract. So if I had one criticism, I would suggest the fact that lots of these contracts look very similar is probably not a good thing. Firms do that because they don't want to be doing anything that's perceived to be deviant. And if they come up with something that's a real good innovation, everyone else can copy it because you can't patent the compensation process, and you've got to tell everybody in your disclosures what you're doing. So there's really a decreased incentive to be super innovative. That being said, there's been an enormous amount of innovation. People coming up with shadow stock, people restricted stock. There's been companies that are tweaking, giving people options and then making those options tradable in over-the-counter markets to try to value them as opposed to using Black-Scholes. So there have been lots of changes. Boards are going to continue to play with these things. And what we shouldn't do as academics, as observers, is look and say, oh, look, this firm paid with these kinds of options and they did very well. And this firm, right, it may be that that's endogenous and those firms are optimizing along their own dimensions, and you can't take out from that and say, oh, therefore everybody should be doing this. Yes?
When you were comparing them to the public company CEOs to private company, and I know you can only do it anecdotally because you really don't have the data, but you know, you're saying that the public company CEOs are underpaid in comparison, but, or this could be, but how are you valuing their stock, all their equity compensation, because private company CEOs aren't getting equity compensation, so they have to get it in cash value. So how are you making that?
Okay, so one, it's a good question, maybe one slight tweak to what you said, and that is, a private equity firm will buy, let's say, Hertz, which was a public company, and they'll do something to Hertz. It was public, it goes private, it's now in this shadowy world. And by the way, one argument for being a little less critical of our public company executives is we're pushing more and more of them into this shadowy world, and from a political standpoint, we just know less. There's less data for me, that's bad. Right, but as a public, we can't even have this conversation really about private. So a mass privatization of the U.S. economy, although may have some benefits, may also be scary in some sense. Okay, so but what happens when they take Hertz private is the private equity firm, who's now the manager, they take all the equity. So there's still some equity, they take it all. And they lever up with a bunch of debt that a bunch of banks will hold, or other people will hold. And then they'll IPO the firm. And there's equity. So the managers, and I'm just guessing here, the managers of these firms, the CEOs, they get some equity in the private equity firm. And the private equity usually, for its investors, takes 20% of the profits just off the top, plus a management fee. And then the executives will get equity when the firm goes public. So I think they are getting equity. And the numbers up there, $100 billion, that's just, that was the New York Times article. It just said, here's the people familiar with the deal said his compensation roughly for this period is going to be about $100 million. So, good question, but we don't know. Now, what I'm doing, partially one of the things I'm doing this summer is taking all the firms that were public, then went private, then are back public, and looking at their public filings about how they're paying, and seeing if, when they went private, if anything in that black box shadowy world changed in the way that they pay executives going forward. Because the private equity firm who's doing the IPO has an incentive to write the most efficient employment contract. If it's as salient as Bev Chuck suggests, and if incentives are misaligned, non-index versus index, and they're just rewarded for luck, CEOs are just rewarded for luck, why wouldn't the private equity firms have an incentive to reward them just for skill? Because investors would pay more for those firms. And so I'm trying to collect that data now and see what the results are. Yes?
Has there been any research to trace how much of the raise in stock performance is really attributable to the CEO's skills as opposed to other market forces?
That's
take a GE example. After Jack Welch leave, the GE stock didn't tank by any measure. So how much was his CEO more of a genius?
Yeah, so this is a great question. Actually, I hate when people do that. All the questions so far have been really great. This is an interesting question. What she's asking is, what is the marginal contribution of labor? I had a slide which I sort of skipped over. There's a thing in securities called the bid-ask spread, right? The bid is how much much the firm, the sort of reservation price for the CEO, how much they're willing to take. The ask is how much they're asking. We're assuming the ask price is not greater than the CEO's marginal contribution to the firm. Right? That's exactly how much value she adds to the firm. The bid is what she'll take. And then somewhere in there, depending on the negotiating skill, the firm will take some of the surplus and the CEO will take some of the surplus. And it'll depend on how good a negotiator they are. My supposition is that CEOs are taking more and more of the surplus. But your question about what is that marginal value? What is the surplus for Jack Welch? No idea. All we can look back on is say, as Kaplan and Rao do in their study, firms with better executives outperform firms with executives who are a little paid lower. But theirs is a circle. That's hard to say there's cause and effect there. Kaplan has another paper out, which I mentioned yesterday, where he looks at evaluations of CEOs along 40 dimensions. And these are evaluations that are commissioned by private equity firms who are looking for CEOs to run their businesses. So they asked some HR people to go out and evaluate CEOs along 40 metrics, and he finds that CEOs with certain skills outperform CEOs with other skills. The punchline is obnoxious, aggressive, jerks. Jerks outperform nice guys. Because a lot of the value of being a CEO is being able to fire. That's, Jack Welch was called Neutron Jack because he fired so many people, right? You've got to be a tough guy or a tough gal, make the tough decisions, but trying to quantify exactly what that value is, we can just look back at anecdotal information, which is not very helpful. So GE hires Jack Welch, they go like gangbusters. IBM, an American institution which was floundering, hires Lou Gerstner, and Lou Gerstner transforms IBM into a global behemoth. Could somebody else have done it? Don't know. Hard to know. Yeah, just one more.
So why do you think that the 8% cost problem would be related to kind of being chummy or some kind of mind tricks or anything, as opposed to avoid wanting to hire someone with a proven track record of good history who's very expensive to protect themselves to be safer? Which I think would be a problem not only for public companies but for the venture firms and the banks, all those.
Okay, so if I understand, boards are risk averse.
Well,
and they want to hire someone.
There's a problem. They want to say, hire the best guy for the most money. We couldn't do anything better than this. So they protect themselves by hiring somebody famous for a lot of money.
Yeah, but think of it this way. If you were the shareholders and you'd make the same decision at a vote, who would the shareholders choose? They choose the person with a proven track record who's made a lot of money because that's the only evidence they have of whether or not they'll be a good fit for the job. So there's something about just human processing of the decision of how much the marginal contribution is or who the best person is for the job that is imperfect, right? And so the board or the shareholders would probably pick the same person. The shareholders aren't going to pick somebody who they've never heard of who might really turn out to be great. They're going to try to pick the guy who is running a very successful division of a company. So it's not clear that that's agency cost unless there's some explanation about why the board would systematically pick different people than the shareholders, which they don't do. Right? The vulture investors who come in, and I've been part of these conversations where vulture investors are trying to decide who the CEO is going to be, and the kind of discussions that they have, and they're the super empowered shareholders, are exactly this kind of thing. Let's look and see how this person did at other firms. And they're being paid a lot, and they must be worth it, and we're going to hire them too.
But there's almost no case that one person knows everything, and they're making decisions themselves. When they just say, I'm going to take a chance on this unknown person,
Yeah, so the 100% owned firm, we wouldn't worry about that. Yeah. But boy, in the case of WorldCom, when they picked Mike Capellas, there were two people who decided. David Matlin, who made an $800 million bet on WorldCom bonds, and WorldCom's one banker, who was the workout specialist for Citibank who loaned them all their money. That's not one person, but it's two, and one of them had bet $800 million in the WorldCom bank. Bankers had probably $6 or $7 billion worth of debt at WorldCom. And if they can't get it right, is all I'm saying, if they're going to be have these heuristics about who they should hire, then that's as good as we're going to do. Okay, thanks everybody for coming.